Okay. Welcome back. So I brought printouts of today's PowerPoint, also last time's PowerPoint. If you haven't gotten them already, you could get them now. We're talking about third generation sequencing and about Pacific Biosciences, single molecule, often circular DNA, so they can read through several times and take an average to get more accuracy on a single DNA molecule at the bottom of an optically engineered well, so they see one molecule at a time. And something that they just published last year, I think it was, 2010, was that they could use this system, which involves making movies of each of these wells, so that they see which colored nucleotide comes in, how long it dwells on the polymerase before it's actually incorporated, at which point it loses its fluorescence, and then how long you have to wait until the next nucleotide comes in for each one. That there's intrinsic in this data, they're looking at the kinetics of synthesis as well as the qualitative conclusion of which base follows which base. But they're seeing how long it takes for each base to go in. And they thought they could use this, and this is a pretty new application, they could use this to look at modifications of the DNA that might alter the ability of the DNA polymerase to proceed through the replication. And I have a postdoc who just got back from a meeting in California where he was very impressed with this presentation. And as I say, they have published it already in the literature, and we'll go over some of that data now. So the modification they're looking at is the most famous modification made to DNA, covalent modification, which is methylation of CpGs. Well, methylation in general they're going to measure. But methylation of CG sequences, and usually called CpG, so you're sure that the order is C followed by G, that a large fraction of CpGs in higher organisms is methylated on the C, on the cytosine. So you can see the difference between the two. This is, well, you don't see T here, but cytosine ring, so cytosine is the base, and if it's methylated, you don't have a picture of this. It's methylated on the five positions, so that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which would be right here. I have this. And methylation is correlated with expression. Now, by coincidence, I just came from talking to a CpG methylation expert from the NIH who gave a seminar at noon in our department. Discussing just this point about how CpG influences initiation of transcription, at least. And so it's pretty complicated. It's always been complicated. It's been known for a long time. It always seems to be on the verge of telling us a lot. But it's been very hard to move off of the correlation kind of conclusion rather than a real cause and effect, though there has been more and more such experiments. They're hard to do experiments. So these CpGs get methylated. The genes in humans, at least, it's methylated also in plants. In humans, but not in Drosophila, which makes you wonder. I mean, how could it be important if it's not also done in Drosophila? In humans, the genes seem to fall into two categories according to their for their promoters, the GC rich ones, which have these islands called CpG rich islands, which extend hundreds of bases upstream of the transcription start site, and these are generally associated with housekeeping genes. And then there's the other category, which does not have such richness of GC content and CPG in particular upstream. And these generally have been associated with so-called Tata box, so T-A-T-A-A, and there's a famous general transcription factor, the Tata binding protein, which recognizes the Tata box. And in many textbooks, it's the Tata box which is the foundation of the core promoter. And then enhancers elaborate on that core promoter capability, enhancing it or repressing it. Now it seems, going into this seminar, I thought that about 50% of the genes had these CPG-rich islands and no Tata box. The Tata binding protein is still involved, even though there's no Tata box. And the other 50% were the Tata, the ones, the promoters that did have Tatas, usually just about 30 bases upstream of the transcription start site. Now, there's Charles Vinson, who talked at noon today, claimed that only about 2% of genes are really Tata box, functional Tata box containing proteins, but his genes. But I didn't think his data wasn't conclusive. Mainly, he saw those that had the Tata box exactly located at minus 28 or within plus or minus 2. There's very few of those. Only 2% of human genes have that situation. And the rest have kind of a little bit more chance of having a Tata box way out to 200 bases upstream. And he thought these were not functional. But he really didn't have, I think, good evidence for that. Anyway, so it's still murky. So there's a methylase that methylates this CPG, and it's lethal in mice if you knock it out. And this, once the CPG becomes methylated, then it becomes an epigenetic mark. So that when the DNA replicates, if one strand is the CPG methylated, then this methylase recognizes that one strand is methylated and it knows to methylate the other strand. So it gets propagated and inherited. So it's a matter of inheritance, but it's not the kind of Watson-Crick type base pairing inheritance, so it's called epigenetic rather than genetic. With the advent of high-throughput resequencing of the human genome, lots of studies have then gone on to look at the so-called methylome to see what is the state of the CPGs in your favorite gene or in all genes. Upstream of the promoter, downstream of the promoter, etc. And the most popular method, although it's our hands, I mean, it's difficult to get to work, is a chemical conversion. So, if you take cytosine and you treat it with some harsh chemicals in the DNA, you can go through an intermediate where it's sulfonated. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It must be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This must be the 5 position. Where it gets sulfonated, and then this sulfonated cytosine can undergo a reaction where the amino group is lost, and the water goes in instead, and then becomes from an enol to a keto form here, and that's just uracil. So cytosine becomes uracil by treating it with this bisulfite. It's HS3-, right? It's not sulfuric acid. Now, if you take your DNA and wherever it has a cytosine, you've treated it, in theory, they all get converted to uracil. And now you do a PCR, and you get like the wrong sequence, because wherever there was a cytosine, you get opposite that. Instead of a G, you get an A because it's changed to a uracil. So you get like a quarter of your bases are wrong. But if you know what the sequence was, you know what it should be, then you can say, well, that was a cytosine, and now it's a uracil. So what good is this? What good is it is that if the if the cytosine is methylated, then it is immune or at least resistant to this chemical transformation to uracil. So it stays as a methyl cytosine and will code for G. So you see which cytosines in your sequence, which is billions, which ones are methyl C and still stay as C, because when you PCR it up and then sequence it, you get C and not T, because the uracil will be converted to T after PCR. So so that's all this slide is showing. This is bisulfide conversion. So they say it's difficult to... it's a harsh treatment. You destroy some of the DNA if you're not careful. And maybe we're not being careful enough. The conversion is not complete, so it's messy. Okay. So Pacific Biosciences say they have a better way to do this, right? Because they can look at the kinetics. So what they published was methylation of adenine, but what they said at this meeting is it also works for, and even in this paper it was not shown, is it also works for methylated cytosine. Right? And that is, I don't know why they put this on top, but this bottom one is where the adenine is not methylated. See, this is methylated adenine. This is just regular adenine. So this is done with bacterial DNA, where you often have, the bacteria don't have the CpG methylation. They have often a GATC, the A is methylated. So here you have a sequence, and these are the dwell times for this sequence. You see there's a red G, and then there's an interval, and then a C, and then a green T, etc. Then you see these intervals, and then the A, and an interval, and then a T. But if that A is methylated, if they put in methylated substrate, and there's no PCR involved in this, this is just a single molecule taken right from their test tube or from a genome, you see there's this long pause before you can get to the next, before you get there. The A is incorporated, but the, I mean, well, it's funny because you expect the T to be incorporated opposite the model, opposite the A. Yeah, so maybe it's this T that's being incorporated. So there's a long delay before it's incorporated. And then you go on TCAA, just as you did over here, TCAA, but the interval is much shorter. So if they can use this, you look at hundreds of molecules and get good statistics and see how long is this delay. So they look at a ratio between the interval with methylation divided by the interval without methylation. Then they present their data that way. The interpulse duration ratio, IPD. So here now they're going along the template position. And in the case where there was where it was adenine methylation, you see there's this spike in this ratio. It goes up like sixfold, or it goes up over twofold. And not only at the position of the methyl A, but also about four bases downstream of that, there's another pause. So this effect is not completely localized to the actual base that's involved. And then here's another one. And then again, four bases downstream, there's another pause. And they did it also for 5-methylcytosine, where it was even a little more complicated. First of all, the pause was just after, it was at a position just after the methylated C, one or two, two or three positions further, and then at five beyond it, again. And they claim this is the same thing. Two here, and then at five, another big one. So, as I say, this is their paper already published, and I think that maybe the data is better now. So that this would make it possible then to just take the DNA out of your sample, out of your human tissue, out of your human tumor, out of your human differentiated cell of one type versus another type, of liver versus heart, whatever, and look directly. Now they only have 50,000 wells per cell, so they can't do the whole genome this way, but you could certainly look at a good fraction of it. Also, I suspect out of these 50,000, many of them will be sort of uninformative, so you may have even a smaller number. But you can certainly look at single genes, even larger genes, and get, in theory, the complete methylation pattern. Right? So that's another advantage of the Pacific Biosciences. You can do things like this. There's no harsh chemical treatment, and there's no PCR involved. You do have to put... linkers on, as we saw, to make these circles, but there's nothing further to do. Right. So now they can do 50,000 of these wells. They can do reeds that go into the low thousands. And in theory, maybe it could even longer. And we didn't talk about it, but they're developing ways to do direct RNA sequencing directly also in these wells, I guess using reverse transcriptase. And they can detect DNA methylation. So I have a few more subjects to talk about while we're talking about high-throughput sequencing. One is, if you consider the uses you've seen mostly are genome-wide data because it's there and because we can. So we get this genome-wide data, but it's expensive. And one way to save money, if you're not interested in the whole genome, but just in part of the genome, or what part of the genome might be you interested in? At one extreme, you could be interested in your favorite gene, that's all. Right? But there are large sections, for instance, like all the proteins of the cell. How are their, what's their genetic information? What is their amino acid sequence, which you can get from the sequence of the mRNA, in which case you don't have to sequence the whole genome, you just have to sequence the exons that go into the mRNA, which is only about 2% of the whole genome. Most of it is introns and intergenic space. So if you had a way just to sequence the exons, that would save 98% of the money that's gone into the actual sequencing. I think to sequence one lane out of the seven lanes available in an Illumina machine is about $10,000. So it's no, I'm sorry, that's the seven lanes, it's $10,000. So one way is to just extract the parts that you want. So the most ambitious of this is in fact to extract all the exons of the cell. So a couple of companies you can do this. Agilent is one, and Roche, the Nimblegen division of Roche, you can do this. Here's the Agilent way. So Agilent and Nimblegen, they're microarray companies originally. Agilent with its the original HP inkjet printers, they can print the DNA onto slides at very close to, with very tiny dots and picoliters of ink, so it's picoliters of bases. And Nimblegen does it with mirrors, not smoke and mirrors, but just mirrors, like on certain TV sets. So they can synthesize, and when you make a microarray, you're making it sort of to spec. You're making specific sequences that's going to stick out of this glass, and the computer is telling you which base to put in next at that position and which base to put in next at the next position, and it's doing this for tens of thousands of positions or millions of positions. So essentially, they're making like oligomers. Like you would order an oligomer from Invitrogen, so you pay $8 or something, and you get a 20-mer. So they're making tens of thousands or millions of these oligomers. And now you can buy, at least from Agilent, you can buy 60 mers. Or you can have custom microarrays made. We are, in fact, making 60 mers from those microarrays just by primer extension off of the microarrays. And they will also, like Nimblegen, will actually shave these oligomers. Instead of using for microarray, they'll shave these oligomers off, all made to spec, and give you this pool of all these oligomers. Essentially, what Agilent has done is they take their microarrays and they make RNA out of it. So this says biotinylated RNA library as base. So they have all the exon sequences, and they make RNA starting with a biotinylated base. And so that all these RNA molecules have a biotin, or it looks like actually the biotin is throughout, right? And then they hybridize it with your total fragmented genomic DNA, now made single-stranded. And then when you have these hybrids, you mix them. So here's their mixed in, the RNA is binding to the DNA. And you only get this for the sequences that are in the RNA, which came off the microarray, which is only the exon sequences and not the intron sequences or the intergenic sequences. Then you mix these with magnetic beads that are coated with streptavidin. They bind the biotin, which binds the RNA, which is hybridized to your DNA, and then you wash them. So they're nice, and that's all you have. Of course, you have background. Right? And then you elute it off, and then finally amplify it. Of course, you have to add these red things, which are the adapters, which allow subsequent PCR of the whole business with just a pair of probes. And then you sequence that. So this is called our DNA capture, and I think it's a very powerful addition now to the deep sequencing armory. Nimblegen from Roche does the same thing. You might be interested, for instance, in 200 genes that have been implicated in cancer. You want to see how they vary in this tumor, in that tumor, in this person, and just isolate those and have the introns as well. So that's another subgenomic capture target. You can imagine others. We ourselves are thinking of just one 40KB region, which has our favorite gene in it, and to look at it in very great detail. So here, this is a little more straightforward. They just make their microarray. And they do it two ways, but this way is very similar to what I just explained with Agilent, except they use DNA, biotinylated DNA instead of RNA. Or they just hybridize the total DNA from their sample, which is the total human genome, onto the microarray, which is just the part that they're interested in, say just the tumor genes. They wash it, and then they just melt it off, either using strong base or just heat. Here's a study where you get some numbers. It's never as good as it sounds. Here's the targeted capture of sequencing from a region of this person's favorite gene, which is a gene concerned implicated in deafness. It's a very recent paper. And so you get an idea here that the high-throughput sequencing was 454, which is not that high-throughput, but is high enough for this. Because after all, just going for a single gene, you don't need to have millions and millions of reads. Right? So he had 400,000 reads, 400,000 short sequences, not so short, sequences that are read by the 454 sequencing. This is by pyro sequencing. And the read lengths range from very short to quite long, 760. And after quality trimming, which is that most of these technologies, the readout, I'll show you an example of this, they give a readout that the computer will, and the detector, it's an optical detection, whether it's flashes of light in 454 or certain fluorescent colors and the other methods, the computer will sense, you know, whether they're looking at something that's 50% over background or that's five times background. So if it's 50% over background, it's not too confident that that's the right call. And so it'll give a confidence level based on criteria like that. So you have a quality, and then you could throw out everything that's below some cutoff. That's according to your taste as to how sloppy you want to be, or you want to capture as much data as possible. So they found 90% were of high quality. And then they want to know if these are real sequences, so they map them back to the human genome, and 99% did in fact map back to the human genome. You say, well, of course it came from the human genome, but usually this number is much lower. For some reason you get junk sequences out of here. Right? But this one was very good. They gave 3,000 that didn't map into the human genome. And out of these, many of them, you see only 142,000, only 400,000 divided, minus 142 is 260,000 of these. 65% of them map to unique places, and the rest map to multiple places. Yeah.
Why would something that came from the human genome not map back to the same thing?
I don't know. It could be contamination. When we did our sequencing, we found, for example, Now we did 36 nucleotides, and we got 36 A's in a row. Right? So what was that? We got that a lot. Right? So my guess was that there was some dust, and the dust attracted the A guy, which was red, and so it looked like A, but it wasn't. But that's not, most of them are real sequences, not just homopolymer like that. And so, you have to PCR these up. You're using pipettes. This is very revealing. Unlike PCR, which gives you what you're looking for and hides everything else, this kind of technique shows you everything. And so if your pipettes are contaminated with plasmid DNA, and you might slip in there. We have seen stuff like this. Even you purify a band on a gel, maybe that gel apparatus is contaminated with plasmids you've used over the years. Now, these were captured for this DFN region, and we had 400 of the 402,000, 40% actually mapped to that region. So it's not like it's a 90% efficient process. It's a 40% efficient process. But that's still okay, because you just take the other and you throw them away. You're not interested in them. You still have, for much less money, you have plenty of sequences, plenty of reads from your sequence. Right? And they're taking from different individuals, deaf people, carriers, whatever, and trying to see where the mutations are. Right? So 25% off target. And so this is sort of the number I wanted to impress you with. It's not 100%, it's about 40% in this case with Nimblegen. Oh, this, I guess I had two different ones. So I did have this guy here, but I still don't see the methylated one. Well, I already discussed all of this. This is on number 9 here. Okay, so what are we using deep sequencing for? And I'm not going to expand upon the obvious, but I'm going to talk about two of the newer techniques, one of which we've been doing, and one of which you read about. So, so by far the biggest application is human genome resequencing. That is, reading these short reads, which are getting longer, but are still kind of too short to be able to give you a sequence from a complicated organism. You could do microbial genomes, maybe de novo sequencing. We never have done it before. But in complicated organisms with a lot of repeated sequences, and that's why a lot of those probes didn't map to unique places, because there's a tremendous amount of repeated sequence. Maybe 50% of our genome is repeated to some degree or another. So it's hard to connect larger regions with such short reads. But if you already know the basic framework and the basic sequence, you know where to place. You map your sequences back up, and you see there's one base change, so you have your mutant. So it's still, since so many genomes have already been sequenced, most of the sequencing is going on, except for the microbial sequencing, I'd say, is now resequencing, and it's good for that. So you can find single nucleotide polymorphisms in the population to see how they track and with genetic disease, and maybe lead you to genes that are implicated in disease. You can find frank mutations. It could be the deletions or additions in addition to base changes. How these polymorphisms distribute in the population, how they're inherited, is there selection for them or against them, as we look at more and more individuals, and that's where a big effort is going on now. I think at Harvard they're trying to do 1,000 individuals. And as the price comes down, the goal of the NIH set was $1,000 per genome, and the last official price I saw was $100,000 per genome, but more recent numbers are coming out into low thousands already. There's also a big effort going into getting the complete genomic sequence of tumors. Tumors are a mess because they're heterogeneous, for one thing. And if you take a solid tumor, for example, or even a blood cell tumor, it's going to be a mixture of different kinds of cells. And so you have to sort of look through that mixture. Even if you had a pure tumor tissue, it could be heterogeneity, because most tumors have genomic instability, and so they have a high mutation rate, and they are intrinsically heterogeneous to begin with. So you won't see, you'll see, you know, two different bases in your DNA preparation at the same position. But it still can be informative, and you won't know whether those were in the same cell. If you see several of these, you don't know if they were from one cell or the other. There's also this background problem. Because of this genetic instability, there's, you know, thousands probably of mutations in a tumor that aren't in the normal tissue of that person. Which ones are just due to a genomic instability and not affecting really the tumor phenotype, and which ones are actually involved in the tumor phenotype, is the big problem to work out. But maybe it could be worked out with enough separate, similar tumors in different people. You see, always these genes are involved, and the other ones should be sort of noise in the background that is averaged out among different tumors. There's a lot of effort going into microbial, which is easier, microbial populations, including viruses, and seeing how viruses, different kinds of viruses, are distributed throughout the world during an epidemic or pandemic, even without it. And how your microbial flora vary with your diet, stress level, geographic location, whatever, or just stochastically during your lifetime, and how this could be correlated with how you feel. Metagenomic sequencing. So there's the great majority of bacteria, which are the biggest source of life on this planet, I think even in terms of grams. Most of them have never been cultured in the laboratory. We don't know how to culture them. But if you scrape a rock and take the DNA that comes off of it, you'll find that on that rock there were hundreds of different species of bacteria, and you can get their DNA sequence from this small amount without ever having to culture them. And especially by looking at ribosomal RNA, you can sort of place them in sort of an evolutionary tree and see which ones, and try and separate out heterogeneous mixtures. So this is called meta-sequencing. Then there's a lot of RNA sequencing. So RNA sequencing is sort of taken over from microarrays, or is about to, or is in the middle of, because it gives much cleaner data than microarrays, which is analog data of intensity of fluorescent signals hybridizing to a DNA on a glass, which is subject to differences in hybridization efficiency, which is not what you want to look at. Whereas the sequences give you this digital data, counts. How many times do you see this sequence which came from this mRNA compared to another one? And so you can just get the entire transcriptome of a given tissue under a given condition. And so there's hundreds of different conditions and tissues and tumor cells and mutant cells that have been being looked at by RNA-seq just to get just good levels for gene expression. Also, new RNAs appearing with this RNA-seq, which didn't distinguish mRNA from any other kind of RNA. We see that a lot of the genome we thought was silent is actually transcribed. As introns are transcribed, pieces of introns are transcribed in the other direction. Intergenic sequences are transcribing RNA. People are quite excited about this. There is this cautionary note that maybe this is just noise. This is that DNA, RNA polymerase can't help itself and is just making this junk. But a lot of them, like the miRNAs, are clearly important. So the miRNAs are these short double-stranded RNAs, form first hairpins, and then are cleaved into double-stranded RNA that can inhibit translation or stimulate the degradation of messenger targets that are complementary to them, right? And it's used by the cell as a regulatory mechanism. And these long non-coding RNAs are a hot topic right now. It's not clear. These could be, you know, thousands of bases long, and it's not clear what they do yet. But they'll probably, some of them will have some role. And then there's splicing isoforms. So a lot of the diversity of the proteome, that is, why we have so many different proteins, and it's thought why we can be such complicated organisms, like humans, or a mouse, or even a Drosophila, with so few genes compared to something like a plant, which doesn't have to do that much, doesn't have that many specialized tissues, doesn't have very complicated behavior, and has even more genes than we do, or a worm, well, again, which has just a few simple functions to do, and has as many genes as we do. So it's thought that a lot of this is due to alternative ways of splicing from the same gene, putting the exons together in different combinations. Clearly, there's some examples where it's just sort of staggering in terms of diversity. So there's Drosophila, I think it's still the champion, the DSCAM gene, which has, maybe 50 exons. Don't quote me on that. But it has a whole regions of the gene where a whole group of exons, maybe 20 exons, one is picked out and the rest are mutually excluded once that one is picked out. And then there's another region where another one out of four is picked out, and another region where one out of 10 is picked out. So altogether, if you looked at all the exons and all the mathematical possibilities, there's 38,000 different possibilities for putting together a messenger RNA from the Drosophila DSCAM gene. And so far, there's nothing to contradict the idea that all 38,000 are in fact realized. It's possible, but certainly low thousands have been documented. So, and it's thought to have something to do with axonal guidance, which is something that governs complicated behavior, like Drosophila and we have. Right? So, splicing, also splicing goes wrong in tumors, like most things go wrong in tumors. So so splicing isoforms is part of gene expression. It's not just the amounts, but the amounts of what mRNA from that particular gene. And of course, there's many, many less complicated than 38,000 gene products from, say, human genes, where over 90% of human genes at one point or another make at least one other, at least two isoforms of the same mRNA. They're different, two different mRNAs. So 90%. That's not to say that most exons are subject to alternative splicing like this. Most exons still are not, because an average gene has about 8 or 9 exons. So if it has two variations, only one of those exons is alternatively spliced, and the rest are constitutively spliced. So about 85% of exons are constitutively spliced, but the 15% that are alternatively spliced are spread among essentially all of the genes. Again, there's a cautionary note that it's not clear that all these isoforms are functional. And it could be that, again, it's just mistakes of the splicing machinery. Nobody's perfect. But certainly, lots of them are functional. And some are give complete, quite different proteins, and some give subtle variations on a given protein that changes the electrical properties of the cell, for example, neural transmission or the kinetics of muscle contraction with different muscle proteins. Now, more recently, there's one could look more deeply, something called GrowSeq. We have RNA-seq, we have GrowSeq. We just wait it out. I should have shut it off. Okay. In GrowSeq, this is pretty neat actually. So you can look at the kinetics of transcription and of splicing, which takes place even as the RNA is being transcribed. One way of doing this is to feed the cell BR. I said here BRDU, but this is wrong. It's BRU. BRDU is the traditional brominated uracil, The where you have bromine instead of methyl on thymidine. In thymidine, you substitute a bromine, which is about the same size as the methyl group. And this is accepted into the DNA by the DNA polymerase and usually causes no problem unless you irradiate it with certain wavelength light. But it's distinguishable. And you can do the same thing with RNA using bromouridine instead of bromodeoxyuridine. And it'll get incorporated into the RNA, where it does cause maybe some splicing problems if it's present at a high level. But there are antibodies you can raise against brominated RNA or DNA that don't react with just the usual thymidine or uracil, thymine or uracil in those nucleic acids. So you can selectively, so you can pulse with bromouridine, and then 15 minutes later, say, extract all the RNA, and you'll get this mostly all that RNA, since genes in 15 minutes for a typical 30 kb gene hasn't even finished transcribing, or it's just about gone through. So you're enriching tremendously for nascent RNA. And so you could ask, what's true about this nascent RNA compared to the final messenger RNA or compared to the DNA? Is intron 1 spliced before intron 2 or vice versa? What is the actual rate of transcription of every single gene? You can get numbers like this. That's called GrowSeq. It's not that it's a growing chain. It's a genomic runoff. So you're watching the RNA runoff, the DNA template. So then there's something that we've been concentrating on for the last couple of years, doing high-throughput genetics rather than genomics, rather than analyzing what's out there and what are the mutants in the human population. We'll make our own mutants and do it in a high-throughput way to take advantage of this splicing, which I'll talk about next. And then there's this drug discovery, which I won't talk about since you read about it already, which I thought is quite an ingenious use of the high-throughput sequencing, essentially using it as a barcode to see what small molecule you have that has been effective in binding a drug target, some protein. So let me talk about our experiments, mostly the work of Shengdong Ke, then a graduate student, now a postdoc in my lab. We're interested in splicing and what are the signals for recognizing the splice sites. Mostly we're concentrating on constitutive splicing, because we don't even understand that. That is, the splice sites themselves don't have enough information to indicate where the splicing should take place. And of course, if you're not accurate with your splicing, then the mRNA comes out to be gibberish. Right? So since splicing was discovered about 30 years ago, a lot has been learned. Certainly the chemistry of removing the introns is known. And it's also been known for a long time that sequences in the exon other than the splice sites and that can be located at variable distances away from the splice sites can enhance the splicing or silence the splicing. If you just look for the sequences themselves around the splice sites and you give some score to them as to how well they agree to the overall real splice sites, you find maybe 10 times as many false sites than real sites. The problem is not that different from transcription, where you see plenty of boxes that would bind, and indeed do bind, transcription factors, and yet are in the middle of genes and are not promoting, apparently, the start of transcription, even though they're there. So there's some additional context effects, and to say that context is easy, but to know what that context means in molecular terms is the big question. Right? So that's what we're sort of after for splicing. So one way to get at it was to ask for put in all possible hexamers, let's say at a position here in this exon, which is not splicing that well. So this is just the gene of our own construction. It's got two outside exons that are from the Chinese hamster dihydrofolate reductase gene, and then this exon is from somewhere from a human gene. And it's splicing at about 10% inclusion, and the other 90% skipped. So we want to know if we put a particular hexamer in here instead of the wild type and substitute it, would it help or would it hinder this 10% splicing? And we could put a score on it. Then we could say, like, we put AAAAAA. How does that work? And we get kind of maybe, well, it doesn't really do too much. How about AAAAAC? Can we do that one? So we could do 4,096 experiments, because that's the number of hexamers you could write down, 4 to the 6th. And we can do it all in one experiment now with high-throughput sequencing. So we just order from Invitrogen, say, give me 25% AGCT at this position, the same thing at these positions, and just 4 bases in from the end. That's where we started. So the experiment then is we incorporate those hexamers we get, you know, with sequences at the end for using as PCR anchors to construct a library of these mini genes with 3 exons, and this should have, in theory, all 4,096 at a roughly equal amount. Turns out not to be true. They're way not equal because DNA synthesis, the production of synthetic DNA does not put a G after a G with the same efficiency as it puts a G after an A. So certain sequences were poorly represented. We originally wanted to do 8 MERS, but 6 MERS was all we could do, because if we wanted to cover every single one. But we could take this library, now that it's been made, we made these as PCR products, so just about a 3 KB sequence. One of the things we learned is we tried to first to make a plasmid library in E. coli, and we found that that influenced the results greatly, that the E. coli hated some sequences and loved other sequences, so we got nowhere near representative random set of sequences. So we ended up with PCR, which is still not perfect, but it was much better than E. coli. And so everything was done at a molecular level. So we get this, each dot then represents a different sequence, and this is their, if we sequence 2 million of them, then we saw there's 1,000 of this, and 200 of these, and 1,400 of those, and we put a number on each of the 4,096 that was input. Then that same library, after it was sequenced, we transfected into human cells going in culture. We wait a day, and then we isolate the RNA made from these, and isolate in particular the RNA that has successfully included this exon. So these are the only guys that could splice. And then we sequence, and then we make cDNA from those, and then we sequence all of those on a luminous sequence of 2 million, and we get a number of reads, and we can convert this into a proportion. So it's like we got 1,000 out of 2 million here, and we got 4,500 out of 2 million here. So there was a fourfold increase in the abundance in the population if we looked at the ones that were included. So that this guy is stimulating splicing. Whereas at the other end, we had 651, which was, you know, less than this, but we got almost nothing. Sometimes we got zero, actually. We got almost nothing out of this guy. So that this sequence that came up at 651, and we know what it is because we sequenced it, is a very strong silencer of splicing. So we could end up by using this enrichment index, the output divided by the input, we could, for one thing, we could infer the strength of that sequence in promoting splicing, and then we could go back and test. We could build some of these, rebuild them with that particular, we did 50 of these, and then see what the proportion of splicing actually is in an individual experiment, how much is skipped and how much is included. And those actual numbers for inclusion agreed very well with our predicted one based on this population study. So we end up with a 4,096 list, and here's our, you know, our best one. We normalize it, so this is about 1, and this is about minus 1. And the average is, and the median is about 0. And so we could put a sequence on each one. So we're trying to use this data now to look for more complicated questions, like how does context affect these scores? And we're finding that, you know, it does affect the scores. If we put our hexamer in a different position, we get different results. One way to validate that these are really used in the real organism is to look at the human is to look at the human genome and ask, take all the exons, or a good number of them, about 100,000 exons, and make a composite exon out of that. So this is the results of the going 50 bases in from the left side or 50 bases in from the right side, and looking at all those positions and then looking for, let's say, the top 400 out of our 4,000 in terms of their enrichment scores, and do those track with the exons. And indeed, the black dots are, if you're coming along on the intron, which are the flanks of this composite look at exons in general, there's all 100,000 flanks, we have some certain frequency of the top 400, and as soon as we get to the exon, they jump up. And as soon as you're down with the exon, they go off. If you look at alternatively spliced exons, that's a funny contraction, they're a little bit less often there, because they have to be, you know, not such great exons if they're going to be skipped sometimes. These are alternative exons that are either included or skipped. It's one type. Right? So this was another kind of validation that our experiment actually gives results that are valid for nature in general. Here's what some of the data looks like. So we would get our sequence. In our special case, we're only looking at, this was 8 mers, actually, you can see, in an 8-mer experiment. So we saw these, and then everything else should be constant, right? Not always, though, because here's one that's a T instead. It should have been a C, and because that was a clone piece of DNA that went into the PCR. So this is an error in the Illumina sequencing, and they have a certain error rate. It's not that tiny, right? So one of our filters was to say, if there's any error on either of these flanks, well, the heck with it. We have plenty of good ones. We don't have to consider that one. Maybe that was a particularly bad sequence. So we throw out that sequence. Then this is the quality code provided by the Illumina machine. And it has all these funny characters, which are just 256 characters from the ASCII code of the computer. And each one reflects a number that you can look up on a table, which is the confidence level that it has. So unless the confidence level was something like 90% overall, and it's multiplying all the confidence levels of the entire sequence by themselves, like 99 times 99, 0.99 times 0.99. If it was, unless it was greater than 0.9, then we threw it out. That gets rid of about half the sequences. So we only looked at the really good half. Right? Because we could afford to, because we had plenty of sequences to work with. The other nice thing about this, which is an important general point, is that when we made these things, these are PCR products. So we're in charge of what we start with. So we start with something that was complementary, say, to this base, and then we put in a difference, though, in the little tail of the PCR product that went in here. We made it either a CG or a TA. So it was like extra, because we're not concerned with this sequence out here. We're only interested in the blue ones. So we could do, for instance, what we did do was duplicate experiments, duplicate transfections, so we have confidence in the data to see that it agrees. Duplicate transfections, except one guy got the CG starting genes, and the other guy got the AT, the TA starting genes. And then, when we're all done, we just mix it all together and we put it all in one lane of an Illumina for $1,000 instead of two lanes for $2,000. So you could use longer ones. You could do obviously 8 combinations with a dimer. With a trimer, you could do 16 combinations with a dimer, and you could do 64 with a trimer. So you could mix if you don't need a lot of data, because now you get 20 million reads out of a single Illumina channel. So if the 1 million is good enough, you could mix 20 experiments in one channel, and each experiment only costs you 1/20th of what it would have cost you otherwise. And so people are doing this. This is called barcoding. Right? So and usually we see only one barcode. Sometimes we see a mixed signal, so we know to throw that one out. That two barcodes in the same spot. So there was something wrong with that spot, so we can throw it out. Now, another experiment of this type is recently published, 2009 actually, by Donna Pear, that's in our department, is one of the collaborators on this. And that was to look at, in this case, they didn't use all random sequences, but rather they took a natural promoter sequence and they mutagenized it heavily. And there was something like 20 bases, so there was like many, many different mutants. And they wanted to know what was the requirement in vivo. Now, was this in vivo? Might have been, I think it was in vivo. It doesn't matter so much. You see the transcription start site is here, and they go from minus 23 to plus 12. Yeah, so that's what? 35 bases. Highly mutagenized so that they had a large number, millions maybe, of different sequences, or hundreds of thousands of different sequences. They wanted to see which ones were good for transcription. The trouble is, transcription starts here, right? So they have all these different sequences out here to minus 23, and they have no idea which ones were the effective ones that made a lot of transcript here and were acted as a good promoter. So they make a more sophisticated use of the barcode. They put a barcode way down here, 128 bases away, right? And they make a complicated barcode, which I won't go into. But the crux of it is that this barcode, that these molecules were now made by Agilent Company as what? About minus 23 is about minus 35 to plus 165, 200 MERS. There was a paper in Nucleic Acids Research about 2 years ago that Agilent could do this, and this was a big step up to make something 200 long with enough fidelity so you have confidence in the sequence. This is synthetic RNA. Usually, you're afraid to go out past 80, even if you just get one sequence and you order it from Invitrogen. So this was a big advance. So they collaborated with Agilent in this pioneering kind of work. They took these made to spec so that they know what they put in here and what they put in is that barcode. So the barcode is all transcribed. So they read this barcode and they know what molecule it came from all the way down here, just as we did. They looked at their input and then they looked at their output and they could tell what was here by sequencing the whole thing, or sequencing the two ends of the whole thing. So these are also experiments that we're trying now to look at splicing, and look at intronic sequences that affect splicing. Okay, I went on a lot about this. Can't help it, it's my own work, I tend to take longer. Okay, so that's the end of the deep sequencing part. And now we're sort of gonna go back to going through topics for how you use technology to ask questions about gene regulation mainly, right? and protein regulation, right? And I'll just leave that in there for the next few topics we're going to cover, the rest of this lecture and next lecture. So before I do that, I do have one more topic that I'm sort of adding on to what Professor Calderon talked about. So he talked about deep sequencing and I talked about deep sequencing. So he talked about mutagenesis, in vitro mutagenesis, and I want to also talk about in vitro mutagenesis because he didn't cover some of the topics I'd like to cover. First is just to say that the method we use in our lab, which we like a lot, is called overlap extension PCR. So now you're trying to make mutants. And these are particular mutants, not 4,096 of them, but just one particular mutant, so you can test an idea. So it's rather straightforward, actually. So you have the sequence that you're interested in. Let's say some promoter sequence, and you want to check for a change of a base in a particular place. So you just make a primer that has that change, indicated by this bump, change from the wild type sequence, and you make another primer that has the same change but going the other direction. And then you do two PCRs, one to the left and one to the right. So you end up with two PCR products that overlap where the mutated region is. And now you can denature these and then rehybridize them to each other, and some of them will just form this again, which gets you nowhere. But those that are coming from the left guy and the right guy that hybridize across the mutated region Now in the PCR reaction, will primer extend? These are like mega primers. The products are primers for the next step. Right? And so at some low frequency, you'll get something a lot longer. And those low frequency guys can be easily picked out now by doing standard PCR using the same two ends, one and two, and they'll only work if you have successfully joined these two regions, and they will have the mutation that you want. So this works pretty well, and then if you have a restriction site in here, you just take this thing out and you clone it back into your gene and you get it expressed and you study it. So it's called overlap extension PCR. And you can make, you know, deletions this way too. Now, suppose you want to, you don't know exactly what you want to do. You know this region is important. You don't have a good idea that this particular base, this is where genetics is probably the most powerful, when you're ignorant. So you want to say, well, I'm not sure. So let's make a whole bunch of mutations in this region, and we'll do a selection and find out which ones work and which ones don't. So how do you make a whole bunch of mutations? So there's essentially two ways to do this in this in a PCR context for, you know, a small region. So this is called cassette mutagenesis. So the cassette implies you have a limited sequence that's, you know, much more than one base, but it's not like mutating a whole genome. It's just mutating, say, 100 bases or 20 bases or 1,000 bases in this region. For instance, an entire protein coding sequence. You might want to mutate at random in order to select out those proteins that are mutated to have improved function. Right? That's a common use of this kind of cassette mutagenesis. So what's convenient is that you can use PCR for this, because if you substitute manganese for magnesium in the usual TAC polymerase PCR mixture, it makes a lot of errors. And you can control the rate of these errors by the ratio of manganese to magnesium in the mixture. And the company will sell you a kit for this, and they will tell you how much to use, but generally you also have to do some pilot experiments to see in your hands what is the frequency, because, you know, too many mutations, you just killed your protein, and too few is not efficient. So this is called error-prone PCR. Yeah, here. Error-prone PCR. And then you can cut out this cassette and stick it back into your gene, and then hopefully select for something. If you don't select for something, you can just screen one by one and find the ones that are interesting and then see what the changes were. So this is genetics. Right? The second way, which is a little more cut and dried, I'd say, a little more expensive maybe, I'm not sure in the end, is you can synthesize the DNA with mutations. Then you're limited to about 80, 100. The synthesis starts to fail, except for those 200 of the latest Agilent thing. It starts to fail because it's an inefficient, it's not 100% efficient to add all these bases, and you start accumulating errors and making shorter things. Maybe not so important if in certain circumstances you could throw away half the genes you've made and still live with it. But anyway, there's plenty of regions that are 100 or less that would be interesting to mutate. And so you can do what's called a doped synthesis. This is unlike the more expensive ordering thousands of specific sequences. Here, this is cheap. You just tell the company, well, I want 90% G at position 1, but put in equal amounts of the other 10% as A, C, and T, let's say. And in the second position, I want 90% C, and then the other three. So you take the wild-type sequence at 90%, or 99%, or 80%, or whatever you think is going to work for you, and so then you'll get this mixture of other bases at various positions. So this is called doped synthesis. You're doping or tainting, contaminating the sequence at various positions by a certain probability. So we'll see some when we get to talk about, you know, making better protein therapeutics, people using these kinds of techniques. Okay, so mostly we've been talking about E. coli as a host for plasmids and studying gene expression there, and maybe a little bit about whole animals like C. elegans, Drosophila, mice. So I want to talk about different model systems for studying gene expression. And we'll start with E. coli and not spend too much time on it except to say as a backdrop for other kinds of systems. The other, just not to keep you in the dark, the other kind of systems we'll talk about will just be yeast and cultured animal cells. So E. coli is very well studied, the best studied organism in the world, and it's relatively inexpensive. They grow fast, and there's a tremendous amount of technology available for them, right? But there are some problems, right? So if you're trying to make a protein, for example, and most recombinant proteins are made in E. coli, no doubt about it, and people put up with these problems. So the folding can be a problem. The way, for instance, the crystallographers in our department, John Hunt and Liang Tong, they're always growing in E. coli, and they can't make these really big things, so they make a smaller thing. They make a single domain, and you see all these structural studies that they took. Well, they purified the C-terminal domain, which folds autonomously into this kind of thing, and they could make that in E. coli. But if they tried to make the whole protein, they couldn't make it. Right? And so they live with that, right? And works pretty much. The domains fold autonomous for they use the right kind of domains, but still it makes you a little uneasy. It'd be nice to do the whole thing. So proteins can misfold in E. coli. And they could be sorted in E. coli to different parts of the cell where they precipitate and form these inclusion bodies, and then people can try to blast apart these inclusion bodies and denature the protein, then renature it again to study its structure and its properties. And this works sometimes. If you're making a product for injection into human bloodstream, you have to worry about endotoxins produced by bacteria in general. These are like polysaccharides that give you some bad immune response. And maybe most seriously is that human proteins, like most higher organism proteins, are not done when they're translated, but they get modified. They get phosphorylated and acetylated. And let's look at some of these modifications. They get sugars put onto them, sometimes in very complex tree-like structures. Right? And we'll talk about that in much more detail in a couple of weeks. They get acidic ester groups put onto them. They get methylated at certain places, phosphorylated, even sulfated. More specific, again, these are, I think, like long-chain fatty acids. And then stranger things, like hydroxylation in proline and lysine, or an extra carboxyl group put onto glutamate. Selenium instead of sulfur in cysteine. Right? I thought I talked about more of these. Oh, here's some of them, right? Here's myristoylation. Always to a glycine, that's the N-terminal of the protein that's going to be modified, and then this long hydrophobic group is used to anchor it to the membrane. So E. coli is not going to do this. The amino group of lysine can get acetylated, takes away the positive charge, a famous change in histones, makes it bind less tightly to DNA without that positive charge. Or the positive charge can be made even stronger by methylating this nitrogen. Trimethylation, that's even a stronger positive charge, or it's charged more for a larger part of the time, also provides this bulky, relatively bulky group that's differentially recognized by chromatin accessory proteins. So you have the monomethyl, dimethyl, as well as the trimethyl. Also, microtubules undergo this kind of methylation to help regulate their activity. Here's selenium instead of cysteine. And that's just on a tRNA, where you have a UGA, normally a stop codon, but in a certain context and with a certain efficiency, you have selenocysteinyl tRNA is used instead of cysteinyl tRNA. And that's not at the normal cysteine codon. Here's this nice one where you put, here's a side chain of glutamate. It's got COOH at the alpha, beta, gamma position. So you get a second carboxyl at the gamma position. You need vitamin K for that. And this modification is present predominantly in the coagulation protein. So if you're low in vitamin K, you'll have bleeding disorder. So all these things, if you wanted to make a good coagulation factor, which are being made as therapeutic proteins, if you couldn't make it in E. coli. So here's some alternative hosts. I think I skipped a... what is this? Okay, I'm going to go back to that. We'll go back to that right now. So before we leave E. coli with all these deficiencies, we have to recognize that it's still used tremendously. So how would you use E. coli? And one thing to always consider when you're going to get your gene expressed in a given host is what promoter should you use. So let me just get you familiar with some of the promoters that are used in E. coli that are popular. So the LAC promoter, which you all learned about in high school probably, where it has it's controlled, an inducible promoter, it's controlled by an operator with a repressor sitting on it. So you connect that to YFG, which is your favorite gene. It could be YFP, your favorite protein. And if you have the LAC repressor, the I gene in E. coli, that makes the repressor that sits on this operator, then it will be shut off, and then you turn it on by inactivating it by having it bind lactose, or more commonly isopropyl thiogalactoside down here, which is non-metabolizable, unlike lactose, which can be split. So this is an analog of lactose, and inactivates the LAC repressor so that the LAC promoter then can function. Now, that's a pretty strong promoter, and you have variants of it, like LAC-UV promoter, which is not on here, which is even stronger. But an even stronger one yet has been made by hybridizing the tryptophan operon promoter with the LAC operon promoter and making a hybrid promoter called TAC, tryptophan and LAC. And then also to use a super repressor mutant of the LAC-I gene, which gives you very high levels of the repressor. And so that if it's really important for you not to have your gene expressed until you want it to be expressed, and instead of having like a 10-fold induction, you want maybe a 1,000-fold induction, or at least a several hundred-fold induction. And so this TAC promoter with this super repressor gene can give you several orders of magnitude of induction by adding IPTG. Another promoter that acts in sort of in the opposite way is the BAD promoter. This stands for three genes of the arabinose utilization operon, and it's induced by arabinose. So E. coli gets arabinose. Rather than inactivating a repressor, the arabinose activates an activator, which is the ARA-C gene. And when it's bound to arabinose, acts as a positive transcription factor, and so you connect that promoter to your favorite gene. And again, you're concerned about background levels when you don't want it made, and in this case you can drive them down further by including glucose in the medium. And you have a phenomenon known as catabolite repression, where if you have glucose present, a lot of alternative carbon source enzymes are repressed by a common mechanism. So you just go take away the glucose and add arabinose, and you get a nice induction. Then there's an amplification you can have using a phage promoter instead of the natural promoter. So the T7 promoter, you can use different ones. Phage T7 is the most popular. It's also used in vitro, as we'll see later. Attach that to your favorite gene. And now you have to add a different RNA polymerase, because the phage TV promoter is specific. Has about an 18 base pair sequence that's specific for the T7 polymerase. T7 polymerase needs that sequence to get started. So you include the polymerase, say, in your vector, or you have it in your E. coli cell ahead of time integrated, and then you come in with your T7 promoter, and it will get transcribed and expressed. And if you want it to be controlled, then you put the T7 polymerase gene under control of the LAC promoter, for example, or any of these other ones. Right? So now you put your gene in with a T7 promoter, but there's no polymerase being made, so nothing happens. Now you add IPTG, say, in this case. The polymerase is made. You get many polymerase molecules made. Each one now can can function to promote high expression then of the T7 promoted, your favorite gene. Okay, said a lot there. Now let's consider yeast. So we're going to talk about yeast, mammalian cells, and later some in vitro systems where you don't even need a cell. Look at your expression. Yeast promoters, if we take the same if we take the same need to know what to use, and there's quite a variety. Some are, and many of them are inducible. Look at this one, seems to be the winner, the famous GAL, the enzymes degrading galactose, GAL 1, 10, and 7, and induced by galactose. But there's other ones. Okay, repression by phosphate for acid phosphatase, the FO5 promoter. There's often used copper, which induces this copper detoxifying enzyme, metallothionine, and a lot of genetic experiments done with that. And you have some constitutive promoters as well. These are strong promoters, pyruvate kinase, strong promoter. So generally, a yeast plasmid, it's a shuttle plasmid, that it has AMP and ORI, so that it'll grow in E. coli. So you can grow it up in E. coli, and then you can transfect yeast. Sometimes, if you want this to be a free-living plasmid, you have a autonomously replicating sequence element here, or ARS, and that enables the yeast DNA polymerase to replicate this circle, so you have several copies per cell. And usually you have a selectable marker, since it's so easy to do in yeast, because you have plenty of oxytrocin yeast, those that are mutated in a base in one of the enzymes of a biosynthetic pathway, and so they won't grow if you leave tryptophan out of the medium. They'll grow fine if you put tryptophan in this case. And so if you put in the missing enzyme here, TRP1, then you know you have a you can select the transfectants on the basis of their ability to grow in tryptophan-free medium. And then, of course, you have a place for your host, your gene. It's not the host gene. This would be the gene that you want made. I think I put that in there. And you have a promoter and you have a terminator. We look at some actual ones that have been used. Here's one with a glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. It's a high-level enzyme of glycolysis. It's usually present at high levels in most organisms. And again, you have the promoter, you have the terminator, you put in your favorite gene. In this case, we have leucine to provide a selective marker against the oxytrophy. People are at the door. All right, so we'll just continue with this yeast next time and then get into mammalian cells.